KPCW News time is now 8:06. We're getting reports of an automobile accident that's happened on eastbound I-80 within about a half a mile of the intersection with 40. Three cars involved, multiple lanes blocked. At the time we got this, which was just a few minutes ago, there had not yet been any emergency vehicles on site, so we may be seeing some significant backup there. We'll continue to follow that story and bring you an update when we have one. Now let's see what we got coming on the weather. Here with a report is Cedric Haynes from the ABC4 Weather Center.
Happy Friday, KPCW listeners. It's time for your forecast for the Wasatch Back for your Friday. Look for lots of sunshine, a couple of high clouds moving through from time to time. Temperatures on your Friday afternoon will climb into the upper 50s in Park City. We're looking at temperatures climbing into the mid-60s for us as it goes throughout your Friday afternoon for the Heber Valley. As we head into your Saturday, we will be tracking some changes. A weak front will be moving closer to the area. That will give us a chance of some isolated showers as we go throughout your Saturday afternoon in the Park City area, and a few isolated showers could make their way down towards the Heber Valley as we get into your Saturday afternoon and Saturday evening. Now, as some cooler air begins to work its way in Saturday night across the Park City area, we do have the potential of seeing some of those rain showers change over to some snow showers. Now, we're not expecting any major accumulations or widespread snow event, but there will be a chance of a few rain and snow showers in Park City Saturday afternoon through Saturday night. Meanwhile, a few rain showers will be possible in the Heber Valley as we go into your Saturday evening. The bigger story with that system will be a brief but potent cold shot that will make its way into the area for your Sunday. So while Saturday will be somewhat decent with the temperatures in the low 50s in Park City for highs and upper 50s in the Heber Valley, by Sunday we're looking at temperatures dipping down into the teens and low 20s by Sunday morning, with high temperatures as we go throughout your Sunday only in the 30s for us in Park City, and we'll see those highs only in the low 40s in the Heber Valley. So it's big change with a little breezy northwesterly wind, and again could have a couple of snow flurries around the area, but no major precipitation is expected. Once we get out of the weekend, though, all things point to a major warm-up as a major heat ridge builds across the western half of the country. Temperatures will start off Monday with highs near 50 in Park City and upper 50s in the Heber Valley. By Tuesday, high temperatures will be in the low 60s in Park City with highs in the upper 60s to near 70 in the Heber Valley. And we are in the mid to upper 70s for highs in the Heber Valley for your Wednesday and Thursday with highs in the low 70s in Park City. That's a look at your latest forecast for the Wasatch Back. I'm ABC4 meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
Yes, Cedric did say that we would be seeing highs in the low 70s next week. Wow. Okay, let's see what this weather for the past few days has done for conditions in the backcountry. On the phone, I have Drew with the Utah Avalanche Center. Morning, Drew.
Hey, morning. You know, it's what we call spring diurnal. We're locked up this morning. We have low danger. It's going to rise to moderate on all steep solar aspects. Starting east, then south, then west, wet, loose avalanches will be possible, particularly if you're overstaying your welcome as the snow becomes damp, wet, and then unsupportable, particularly in wind-sheltered terrain. The winds are still raking the highest peaks out of the west-northwest. Some gusts even up to 70, currently at 11,000 feet. It's probably stay cool up there, but I would imagine, once again, with direct sun and the warming temperatures, wet loose will be your primary concern as well. We've been talking about the persistent weak layer from January that's been buried and has been problematic for a while. We're viewing this as generally dormant currently, but with the heat dome in place coming in for next week, we think that's going to come alive again with free water percolating down to those weak layers. So stay tuned. We'll see how that plays out for next week.
All right, Drew, thanks. We will be in touch. I think, are we getting pretty near the end, you think?
Well, some would argue that we've been getting near the end for weeks now.
Yeah.
But I will say the models might hint at some active weather after the heat dome. So we'll see. I don't know if we're dead yet. We'll see.
All right, Drew, thanks, and have a good week.
Thanks so much.
Coming up, I'll be speaking with federal homicide prosecutor Jen Moiskens and KPCW's own Connor Thomas about this week's developments in the Corey Richens trial. Then Justin Jones. He is the director of the Gary R. Herbert Institute for Public Policy at UVU. He's going to stop by to talk about voter security, and we will finish our hour by speaking with Park City Mark Recreation Program Supervisor Megan Levin. Stay tuned. We are now joined in the studio by former federal homicide prosecutor Jen Moiskens and Connor Thomas, who has been sitting through the entire Corey Richin trial. Good morning, and thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Okay, Jen, thanks for coming back this week. I want to start at the end and work backwards. Throughout the proceeding, the defense was indicating that they would be presenting a number of witnesses. And yet, yesterday, they rested without calling one. And much of the media, if you looked at any of the media this morning, were all saying, this was a big surprise. Wasn't a big surprise to you, was it, Jen?
It was not. I think you and I have talked about this for several weeks. I said they were going to present no case or minimal case, and that's what they did.
What did you think of that strategy? Is that what you would have expected a good defense lawyer to do?
I think in this case, they have their strongest arguments already. I don't think they need to put stuff on and open the door to weakening what those arguments are and distracting from the strength of what they have.
Do you think, Connor, you were there, do you think that the courtroom was surprised, and in particular, do you think the prosecution was surprised?
I don't know. I mean, it's like Jen said, they have plenty of good reasons not to present a case. The reason I wrote that the courtroom was surprised is I think because of all the public, the gallery, they'd heard the defense talking about calling witnesses. I think people behind the bar were probably surprised at this turn of events. Technically, they did present one witness. They did direct of one of the prosecutor's witnesses because of some travel complications. They interviewed or questioned Ali Staking, Corey Richin's friend. So technically, they presented a tiny case.
Okay. So there's been a lot on social media. There's been a really interesting number of what I would call fanboy commentary on the judge. People are really think that he's pretty wonderful. But from a technical perspective, Jen, you've seen a lot of judges. What did you think of his performance?
I wish that I had had this judge in many of my trials where I did not have such a strong judge. So I think first and foremost, being a trial judge, especially in a high-stakes criminal case, is very difficult, and I'll explain why. So the attorneys, for months and weeks leading up to the trial, will write motions, very clearly state legal positions, they'll write the case law. Everybody has time to try to resolve as many legal issues as they can. But once the trial starts, you've got a ticking clock where you've got a jury sitting in the box, all these people waiting, and a judge is always faced with issues that come up that you don't have time to sit, really think about, the parties don't have time to brief, and he's got to decide them. And if you don't have a judge that knows the rules of evidence, if you don't have a judge that is confident or has control of the courtroom, what typically will happen is chaos begins to ensue and it goes off the rails. And the first way this happens is that typically a non-confident judge will start to get a bit emotional, less patient, and will often give in to the defense for exactly what they want. And the reason is this. If a defendant is convicted at trial, on appeal, they get to challenge everything that they didn't get and wanted during the trial as an appellate issue. If the defendant is convicted but got what they want, hey, the judge has preserved the case. The government gets no appeal if there is an acquittal by a jury. So if the judge got it wrong every time he ruled in favor of the defendant, guess what? Government doesn't get anything. So less confident judges will often go the way of these last minute defense requests or objections just to try to preserve the record and keep the case going.
And you know, and you got to watch him up close and personal, Connor. The thing about that Jen just said is he has to make a decision in the spur of the moment. The appellate process, those people will be able to scrutinize it and take all the time to show what he did, quote, wrong. Was he as confident in the courtroom as it felt like on the video stream?
I think so. I think the biggest highest stake moment as far as a decision he had to make this week was this William Norris testimony that the defense really wanted to come in. This was some guy who was prepared to testify that Eric Richins had asked him for fentanyl in 2019. And at first, well, the prosecutors were complaining because they said, Your Honor, after you ruled this would be inadmissible hearsay, they had him call the sheriff's office so that now they can make this argument that the sheriff's office never investigated a credible claim of some other way that this death would have happened. So he was really resistant to that at first. He said, give me five, and he came back with some case from 2009 that said it would need to come in. But the the smart thing about it was he looked at all the evidence that he had ruled it inadmissible, and he said, hey, defense, some of the prosecutor stuff is going to have to come back in, too. And so they had to make a decision.
This was an amazing moment where, again, for those of us who were watching on the stream and for you in the courtroom, this was as close to Hollywood as it gets. Because, Jen, let's take it a little step deeper. What the defense wanted to introduce was evidence of this person who had said that once Eric Richens asked for fentanyl. And that would be hearsay, right?
Well, what they were trying to get in was Eric's statement.
Right.
They wanted to put in a statement by Eric that he was asking the friend for fentanyl 3 years earlier, 3 years before his death. An out-of-court statement was being offered for the truth of the matter asserted. That is, that Eric did, in fact, say, I want fentanyl, and made the statement. That is hearsay. Now, there are exceptions to the hearsay rule, but this didn't fall under any of the exceptions. And the judge had ruled on this pretrial. This had been, he'd had that briefing and all of that time. Now, there is an exception to how this can come in. And I've actually used it in two cases, affirmatively myself, which is that if you have a piece of inadmissible evidence, it can come in. They weren't seeking to admit it for the truth of the matter. But let's be clear, they were backdooring it in because they wanted
The jury gets an impression,
right.
Yeah.
They wanted that. But what they were saying is, we want to challenge the quality of the government's investigation. And if we have a piece of evidence, and if the government didn't follow it up, that challenges the quality of the investigation. And there is case authority that says, yeah, they can challenge it. Now, the jury will be instructed, you can't consider this for the truth. But let's be honest, it's in their brain. So then, but what they didn't consider, and what the judge properly, in my view, found, was that if you do that, the prosecution is then permitted with its own evidence to include its own inadmissible hearsay, otherwise inadmissible hearsay, to put in why the government and the law enforcement focused on Corey Richens. And in this case, what the government had was a witness who had said that Corey had tried to buy fentanyl from him, and he told her how dangerous it was. And a second witness, who contemporaneous with the death, was saying, don't worry, Carmen Lauber's going to get us some money because she just sold fentanyl to someone. So the evidence that the government would have, which again, not for the truth, but boy, they could put it in the jury's mind, was that Corey Richens is out here getting fentanyl, and she got fentanyl from Carmen. So what the judge said to the defense is, legally, you have a right to present this, but this is, and I think the quote was, high stakes poker. You better decide if this is what you want. And they took a break and decided, and I think wisely, chose not to try to get this in.
And of course, if this were a TV show, they would have gone to commercial. And when they came back, right, they played the dramatic music, but it was incredibly intense. And it was a very, very dramatic moment. Okay, I think they made the right. You think they made the right decision? I think that evidence about the phone call, and I guess they would have been able to play the audio of the phone call where, you know, he says, don't worry, she's got money. She just sold you know fentanyl to Corey Richens. I think that would have been devastating. Which sort of gets us back to, you know, what you think about the way the case has gone in. The state made a decision to put on the lead detective last. That seems to be fairly conventional, but do you think it was the right call?
So I think it is conventional. Typically you end your presentation in the prosecution with the lead detective. He's what you call your cleanup witness. We've got little pieces of evidence or little facts that we just need to get out. This is the witness that can do it. It is the classic way to do it. What I do not like is how much time elapsed between Carmen and Robert Crozier's testimony and any witness to address all of the problematic issues they had. And again, this goes back to what we've talked about in the last two episodes. I think the way the prosecution presented those witnesses, the way they didn't front and embrace the weaknesses, and the way they didn't immediately address it. They could have put this witness on to address that point and then made him a cleanup. They could have put the other detective who was in the room to address it. But they let a week and a half go by with the jury, frankly, thinking these two witnesses are really, really problematic. And I think the detective did what he had to clean up. I think there was cleanup to be done. I personally think they waited too long to do it.
Go ahead.
To remind listeners, the issue with Carmen Lauber and Robert Crozier, who are part of this chain of alleged drug dealing that leads to Corey Richens, is that Crozier says he sold oxycodone, Lauber says she got fentanyl, and then these stories, it's sort of this, Rashomon effect of there was a drug deal that went down in Draper, but we don't know what was sold. So the detective had two functions, was to fix that problem, but also they were able to introduce a lot of documents, which we don't exactly know what they're going to do with that closing yet. And that was interesting to see. People that have followed this case really closely will remember things like the Walk the Dog letter. There's an orange notebook that was apparently a journal of Corey Richens that she kept notes about the day and night before Eric's death and then the months afterward. Those are all in now through Detective O'Driscoll, but we don't know what they're going to say about them at closing yet.
But I bet we can get a prediction. First of all, for those who haven't been following it closely, 15 seconds on what the so-called Walk the Dog letter was, because it's a pretty important document.
Yeah, so what it's interesting. The jury, again, is not allowed to consider whether or not Ms. Richens has been in custody when they're thinking about their verdict, and so they've been careful to call this a letter that was found among her personal possessions. Well, she's been at the Summit County Jail for 3 years. This was something that was in an LSAT book, in an envelope that was labeled for her attorney, and it was initially 6 pages, but potentially part of a 64 or 65 page thing that tells a story about Eric going to Mexico and getting potentially laced marijuana gummies there. It seemed like Corey Richens, one of her defense narratives of this is actually what happened, not what prosecutors say, and it was addressed to her mother. Prosecutors at the time when it was found thought it was trying to induce certain testimony on the stand.
Well, there is language in there that says it very comes close to saying this is what my brother needs to say. On information and belief, this is what happened. So it's a pretty significant document. Jen, let's talk about. There's a couple things that are going to happen now. Okay, the first thing that's going to happen is that this afternoon they're going to be talking about jury instructions. What are jury instructions and how important is this part of the case?
So jury instructions are very important from a legal perspective. It is one of the number one ways that a case can get reversed on appeal. If we get the instructions wrong, then that is really, really a dangerous appellate issue. So they have to take their time and do this. So jury instructions, just like at the beginning of the case, for those who were there or watched, the judge gives legal instructions to the jury. This is a more comprehensive, full set of instructions that describes the elements that have to be found. He gives them all the parameters of the law about what they can consider, how they can consider, what they can do with this batch of evidence in front of them and what they cannot do. And it's really, really important that you get this right. And so there's always this, we call it a charging conference or jury instruction conference done. There's always a break so that the parties can really try to get it right. Everybody wants this done well and wants it done right. And so that's what they're having today so that they can hammer out the written instructions that the judge will read and provide to the jury so the jury knows when I'm considering the evidence, what are the legal parameters that I've got to instruct me on how I can, what I can do with it and what I can't do with it.
Now, fair, a lot of this is boilerplate, but there are always going to be a few that they argue about. What would you anticipate they're going to be arguing about today?
Well, I think they're going to be arguing on a few pieces of evidence about how they can consider it. So for some of these pieces, like if the Norris thing had come in, well, you can consider it for this purpose, but not this purpose. So some of the evidence, like the impeachment evidence that they wanted to get in and say, well, I'm just impeaching him. I'm offering this hearsay, but it's not for the truth. It's only to see they're not telling the truth. So, for example, one thing that I think is important is the prosecution pushed to get Robert Crozier's earlier statements to law enforcement in. And in that earlier statement, he said he sold fentanyl. Here's the thing. If I'm the defense, I've got to focus and say, Your Honor, you have to be very clear. They cannot consider that for the truth of the matter asserted. They can only consider that to impeach his statement that this is oxycodone. And I think the defense really has to hit hard on that. I think the prosecution needs to hit hard on if they're trying to allege and suggest that Eric Richens purchased fentanyl or had his own case of fentanyl, there actually isn't any evidence of that. And they were trying to get to it from other things, and they just didn't. It was all impeachment, not proper truth of the matter. You can consider it as actual evidence.
I'm curious how granular, and this is a question for you two, like how granular do the jury instructions get? Because I'm sitting there, I'm decent at taking notes, but it's nice when it's live streamed because I can just review the transcript of what actually happened. But they're getting instructed on evidence as it comes in as well, and they're saying, okay, this has been ruled admissible, but do not consider, you can consider Corey Richens' statements for the truth of the matter, any purpose, not the voice of this recording who is not Corey Richens. And it's a lot to write down and remember. Do they get a refresher? Is that what this is for?
Yeah, so the judge will read to them very detailed instructions. And yes, they get, we call short instructions, but this is the comprehensive set. And if for some reason we forgot a sentence or didn't instruct them on one little thing, this fixes it.
Yeah.
If you do it right. So the judge reads. It usually takes 45 minutes to an hour. Thank goodness this judge has a really great voice because otherwise it can get mind numbing. And then they're given a copy or copies to take back with them so they can refer to it. And when I say granular, we are talking the parties will argue about and or. They'll argue about this adverb or not this adverb. There are pattern instructions as a starting point, but you always have to modify them based on the facts of the case and what has happened to make them accurate for this case.
Okay, last question. Jen, a big moment for both the prosecution and defense. What do they got to do in closing?
Okay, so in closing, just to kind of overview, I always view closing for the parties as this. It's a Monet painting. The defense wants that jury to get up close, look at those really messy brushstrokes, and show you all the problems that they, look, if you focus on this, you can't see the painting. The government says, I want you to take a step back and look at this painting. Can you see what it is? If you can see this picture, we've proven our case. So if I'm the defense, I would tackle the biggest problem with this case, which isn't just Robert Crozier and Carmen Lauber. It is that the prosecution oversold details they didn't have to oversell and failed to front several key issues. So if I'm them, I'm sort of challenging the credibility of the government by tackling the fact that although they didn't have to present a single piece of evidence because the burden lies with the government and always does, they, the defense, had to be the ones to first tell you these were cooperators. We had to be the first ones. By the way, they had full immunity. We had to be the one to tell you that Robert Crozier was going to, this was oxy, not fentanyl. That's not what he said. We had to be the one to tell you about that empty pill bottle on his bed. We had to be the one to tell you about all of these things. And to say that the government's told you a story, but they haven't filled it in with evidence, they want you to trust them. The law doesn't let you trust them. You have to base it on evidence. If I'm the defense, that's what I would do. If I'm the government, they have a strong case. If they can just get out of the way and focus on the actual evidence instead of these minutiae details that, frankly, they can't prove and don't matter, I would focus on the money, the money, the money. This is a woman who stole money from her husband. He put stuff in trust because it was deceitful, took money from the business, from his business, stole from her friend her life savings and lied to her about it, and was in such deep debt. She's a woman who said, this would be better if my husband was dead, and then you look at her behavior, you have two people. We know a drug transaction happened, the phone records corroborated, and this is a woman who's communicating with Carmen as this is happening, and by the way, her husband's dead. And then, is this a grieving widow? When you listen to that 911 call, when you look at that tape of the police there, and when you look at her having a drunken party
yes.
the next day.
Yep.
And that's what I would focus on, and focus on the fact that these are not all coincidences. This is the evidence that proves to you beyond reasonable doubt.
Jen Moiskens, thanks for spending so much time with us during the trial. Connor, thanks for spending so much time at the trial. My guess is this is going to go to the jury sometime early next week, and maybe by next Friday we'll have a verdict. Maybe not.
Yeah, I think it'll go by Monday, and I expect a verdict within 2 days.
Okay. Thanks for spending time with us. There's another prediction from Jen Moiskens. Justin Jones, the executive director of the Gary Herbert Institute for Public Policy, is here. He's going to be talking about the work that the Public Policy Institute has done. Election security is a topic of significant public discussion these days. Indeed, the Utah legislature agreed to fund a new study by UVU to examine the security of Utah's longstanding vote-by-mail system. Well, that study is yet to be completed and probably hasn't even gotten started yet. The Herbert Institute has been studying a variety of voter issues for some time now. And here to talk about that work is Executive Director Justin Jones. Good morning. Thanks for being here.
Good morning. Grateful to be here.
Okay, Justin, let's talk about what is the Institute and what kind of work have they been doing in the election field?
You bet. The Institute was actually an idea that I had while serving as the chief of staff to the president at the time. We realized UVU was the only institution in Utah that didn't have a center or a place for students to gather and talk about public policy issues or to invite an elected official to campus. So we started thinking about that. At the time, we knew there was really only one person that has had a long-term impact on UVU, and that was our then sitting governor, Gary Herbert. Since then, he's obviously left office in 21, and we've been building this institute since then. And his number one request of students and faculty as we began is to talk about election integrity and to talk about, at that time, obviously there's a lot of national conversation about whether elections were stolen or whatever, you know, they were discussing at the time, which actually continues today. And we set our sights on looking into Utah's elections. Are they something that can be trusted?
And Utah has been sort of, has had a lot, there are a lot of systems that go into making an election fair, proper, and with integrity. So I know that there was a 2024 study. Was that the first one you guys did on Utah election study? Utah election.
It is.
Yeah. And the 2024 study was called Elections Project Voter Access and Ballot Security. Let's talk about the systems that you looked at. I think you start with registration, right?
Absolutely. I mean, it's important to note that, I mean, this is, elections is an essential part of our democracy. And being able to register to vote is something that I think we take for granted. But we need easy access to the ballot for those who are eligible to vote. And that's part of our Constitution. And in fact, it's our U.S. Constitution delegates that to the states. And then after that, we use county clerks. When we think about the separation of powers between judicial, legislative, executive, we think of that vertical sort of separation of powers. But the United States is really unique in that it also has this vertical called federalism, mm-hmm. A vertical separation where we delegate responsibility, especially in elections, down to the most local level. Our county clerks shoulder the majority of the responsibility. And you go and you register to vote, and then do you have access to the ballot? That was really one of our big concerns. Access to the ballot, can an eligible, a registered voter get access and vote? Then it becomes really a mathematical problem after that. Does my vote and the opinion that I've marked on my ballot actually get counted accurately and have an impact?
So let's start with registration. What when you went back and looked at that, you talked about the goals. Is it easy for those who are qualified to register? What conclusions did you draw back then, and how do you feel about Utah's registration system?
Yeah, we felt like that it was fine. I mean,
that's a good grade.
Listen, there isn't a perfect system of election. Well, there is. Mathematically speaking, it's a dictatorship,
right.
And everyone is told how to vote. That's not, fortunately, where we live. But there are different ways. Anyway, but registering to vote in Utah is simple. It's easy. In fact, you can register to vote up until Election Day. That gives great access to the ballot. You know, I work with students every day. We have almost 49,000 students at UVU, and for many of them, it's their first opportunity to vote. And being able to have that express their desire to vote and choose someone or vote on an issue. It's their first time. They're very excited, and they appreciate the easy access.
And
to the
of course, there's a hot topic now about the extent to which identification is required to vote, to register. Does Utah require identification to register?
They do, absolutely. It has to be verified. You have to do that. It's not super stringent. You know, you bring your driver's license or other identification. I think that, you know, Utah's also leading out in something that's very unique and love to talk maybe in a, on a future topic about state-endorsed digital identity, which is, or SETI, it's called. Utah's leading out. In fact, the ACLU recently wrote an article, released that only one state in the country is really looking at identity in the right way, and that's Utah. It's a separate issue, one would think. However, I think it's going to be able to help us really secure our elections when we think about the ability to have a verifiable digital identity on our phone that could actually geolocate. I'm standing at a ballot box and I could submit it. You know, we're going to look into that over the next few months. We have to report in October to the Legislative Interim Committee, and we're excited to really look into, we've already been looking at SETI, but looking at elections in concert with a digital identity is perhaps an opportunity for Utah to have that verifiable identification.
I realize it's a digression, but it's too tempting. Is this the thing that when I walk through the airport, there's those signs that say, get your digital ID? Is that what we're talking about?
You know, the signs at the airport are your driver's license with a gold star, right? And is it,
that's the real ID thing. There is one that goes goes on to talk about, you know, the new Utah, sign up for the new Utah digital ID.
There is a mobile driver's license, and there's a program that does that. There's some concerns, frankly, that we've encountered as we've researched that about tracking and
that was
things
exactly
like that.
My concern.
You know, Utah in SB 275, State Endorsed Digital Identity Program Amendments, they just promoted a Bill of Rights for individual identity, and the fact that we own our identity, the government only validates it. It's important as we think about elections that the right people are voting, eligible voters are voting, and perhaps the two things that I think Utah has done well or is doing well is promoting a digital identity, and we've also had a long history of vote by mail and doing it in a way that has been really proven. Now, are there exceptions? Yes. Are there mistakes? Considering the thousands, hundreds of thousands of people who vote in every election, it's likely that there may be mistakes, but widespread conspiracy, widespread, election fraud, we found that that is not the case.
I want to talk about that a little more, but first of all, let's set a little backdrop. I believe that Utah's been voting by mail for a long time. How long has it been?
That's right. Yeah. Oh, Utah's been voting by mail since... Oh, I have to look at my numbers, but
approximately,
over 20 years.
Yeah. Okay.
And we've been doing it even longer when you think about absentee ballots.
Right.
But really the primary, and in 2020, the legislature passed a bill that required that vote by mail is the primary form. That's the default. And I think that's been much of the conversation the last couple sessions is whether we should default to vote by mail.
So, and you said a few minutes ago that you had some confidence. No system's perfect, but on what basis do you derive that confidence? To what extent have you guys tried to look to understand whether there are problems in our vote-by-mail system?
Our students and faculty visited county clerks and walked us through the process. And it's fascinating, and they are very careful. One person is ever alone with ballots. The chain of custody, as in it, goes from the ballot box. Two people are carrying it to the clerk, to the counting, or to the place where they will count the ballots. And then the whole process, nothing's connected to the internet. They even have a clear tube if there's any, you know, wires connecting from the ballot counter to the computer that takes it. They just are really trying to be very transparent in the way that this works. And then the whole room surrounded by glass and people can observe the counting. They want people to visit them. They want to answer the public's questions regarding this.
So let's sort of walk through a little bit about the process, just so people understand the nuts and bolts. What is the process by which Utah sort of processes and tabulates votes?
Yeah, so the thing I love about mail-in balloting is that especially I have some new voters. I have, young adults that we get our ballots in the mail and then we sit down and we get to talk about it over the table and we get to talk about the candidates and do research and think about it. the ballots are usually sent out a couple weeks or more ahead of the vote. Then we mark our ballots, we sign, and we follow the process on the envelope. Each county may be a little different, but and then we take our ballots to a ballot box and drop them.
Or the mail.
Or the mail. Right. We can put them in the mail. The ballot box has security. It has a camera. It takes a picture, basically, every time you drop a ballot in there. It has other technology in it. But it's not scanned. There isn't anyone verifying your identity at that place. And I think that's one of the things the legislature has asked the Herbert Institute to study. And then from there, it's gathered every few hours sometimes, especially on election day, and taken to a ballot place where it's two people are always with these ballots. And then they start opening and counting them, and they run them through a machine.
I was going to say, is it a machine that they run it through?
They do. It's an optical reader. It essentially looks at, and it's comparing your signature with your signature on your driver's license or previous your voter registration signature. And if it's at all off, that ballot's kicked out.
Goes to a human.
Yep, goes to a human to verify, and if they don't like it, then they cure the ballot, meaning they reach out by calling, emailing, and mailing you a letter saying, we're not sure this is you, can you come verify it, or will you verify it? Ultimately, they end up sending a letter that you can sign and mail back that says, yes, that's my ballot.
Okay, so the ballots come into a special room that always has two people in it. It's run through the counter. What happens next?
Then it's tabulated, so that they are able to, from that that reader, decide who and what you voted for, and then that information is gathered and then is given to the Lieutenant Governor's office to tabulate the statewide election results.
So I'm in Utah County. You're using Utah County.
It is.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I'm in Utah County. We've run the ballots through the machine. It's got a number. How does that number? I really want people to hear just how precise this process is. There's a number. Is that number electronically sent to the Lieutenant Governors? Does somebody write it down and call? How does it work?
Yeah. No, a machine gives a number, the counting machine gives numbers that it is verified and then updated. And I also want to mention that before any of the machines start counting, there is a test, and then after, and if there's any issues, they make sure to fix it. Then those numbers are sent
transmitted to the
Lieutenant Governor's office. The information from the machine directly isn't sent right to the LG's or the Lieutenant Governor's office. It's tabulated by the clerk, and an audit is certified and then sent.
Okay. All right. And then what happens to the underlying ballots? Are they retained for potential recounts?
You know, I've been amazed. We've been part of a group out of Johns Hopkins, the Agora Institute, with others around the country looking at election security, and we've partnered with them. And I've been surprised to hear there are states that it's electronic voting, but they don't have a record. Nothing's printed. The thing that I love, or the thing that we've loved about the way Utah, again, not perfect, but that you can go back and validate and verify. I can actually take a stack of ballots, count them, and validate that, yes, what the county clerk, the board of canvassers, usually the county commission, has validated, they're true. You can, and really that's the scientific method, right? We've created this function, and anyone can go back and validate it. Now, are there better ways? Are there rumors, yes, of widespread, election interference and all that? I don't know. I think that's part. I doubt there isn't, at least as far as we're concerned in Utah. I think it's very difficult. You think about 29 clerks, an amazing set of elections professionals are supporting each of those county clerks. And then you think about 50 states and how that works. The fact is, it would be really mathematically improbable that there's a widespread conspiracy to do all that. Now, are there mistakes? Yes. Are there ways that can be improved? We believe there can be, and we hope to discover more.
Let's talk about that, Justin. What did the Utah legislature ask you to do?
The first thing they asked us to do in this study was to compare Utah with other states that don't use a mail-in balloting as their primary means of voting. And then they want us to analyze the potential and actual fraud in Utah. So taking a look at that compare it to other states. And then the accuracy or inaccuracy of voter rolls. Recent claims of, several hundred people who had passed away or died voted in Utah's election. We're going to find out. We're going to take a look at that. That's a claim.
It's a claim, right?
By legislators. We're going to see if that's happened. I mean, eventually, there is a lag between when the ballots are mailed out and when Election Day happens. And, I have aging parents, I know, and recently in-laws that have passed away, they've voted and passed away before Election Day. Things like that. Now, is that a high percentage? It's very low, but we can look into that.
Really interesting question. In that circumstance, should that vote have been counted? I mean, they were valid voter when they put it in the mail.
Yeah.
So that's not a fraud issue. This is an interesting project for you guys. I bet you're pretty excited about it. How many people will be involved and what kinds of steps will you be taking? How do you do this?
I'm not a researcher, but I do know several thousand actually here at UVU with our professors. We've been able to partner with excellent professors. My passion really from the beginning with creating the Herbert Institute has been, how do I give students these real world opportunities to have their name on a paper and have an impact in public policy? So we have a group of students that are familiar, former legislative interns and others that'll work probably five or six students, along with a couple faculty that'll work together throughout the summer. We have a budget. We'll be able to travel not only around the state, we may need to visit some other states and bring experts in. So we're very excited about this opportunity.
Okay. Hopefully someone will come back and talk to us about it after it's done.
Any time I can drive to Park City, I would love that. We'd love that.
I only wish we had those. Justin, thanks so much for spending time with us.
Thank you so much.
Well, far too soon, it seems that spring is in the air. Here to talk about some of the opportunities for spring recreation in Park City is Megan Levin. She's the Park City Recreation Program Supervisor. Good morning. Thanks for being here.
Good morning, Roger.
So, Megan, can you give us the scope? Before we get down to what's specific, let's just talk about sort of the broad scope of what kinds of recreation opportunities the Park City presents.
Yeah, I mean, we have a wide variety of programs from tennis, pickleball, spring youth and adult soccer, wilderness first aid classes, our spring bike fit. I mean, the list goes on and on and on.
Mm-hmm. And where do you run those out of?
We run them out of the Mark, but some of them are out at Quinn's, on the fields there, on the turf, like especially our adult soccer program. But most of them, I would say, are at the Mark.
And, of course, talking about Quinn's, let's talk about one of the ones I know you want to talk about, the Adult 7x7 Social Soccer League.
Yes, super excited. We ran this, our inaugural season was last year, and so we're trying to run it again this spring. And it's a social soccer league, which is unique to our adult sport programs because we're focusing on the social aspect. People are signing up individually. And then you can have one friend request, and we place them on a team to make even, hopefully even teams, and everyone can come out, and the emphasis is on meeting new people and playing soccer outside.
And I suppose that word social means that we would not expect to see a lot of roughhousing, that it's a pretty friendly game.
That's the goal, yes.
And of course, how long will that season last, and how many games will they play?
Yeah, so it really depends on how many people we can get to sign up for the amount of teams we can make, but it starts April 16th. We play on Thursday nights at Quinn's, and it goes through middle of June.
And what time do you play?
We play, it'll vary. Again, depends on how many teams we get, but probably around 7 and 8 p.m.
Perfect kind of Thursday night social event. And my guess is that there are some people who decamp to another social venue after the games.
Yes, and we will have an end of season barbecue too.
Excellent. Okay, so once again, talk about how people sign up, where they get the information if they want to get into this 7x7 social soccer league.
Yes, so registration is already open. It's $50, and you can go on our website, parkcityrecreation.org. And check it out. Registration will close on April 1st.
And since we're talking about recreation under the lights, let's talk about softball.
Yeah. So softball is a team registration. So coach and manager will sign the team up. I would really like to encourage local businesses to sign a team up of employees. It's great team building and fun. Games will start the first week of June, and we play at City Park from 6 to 10 p.m. We have four leagues, Monday through Thursday. Our Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday leagues are co-ed, recreational focus, and then our Thursday league is men's, of course, still recreational.
I don't know, the way you said that, something tells me that that Thursday league might be a little more intense.
I don't know. I think people have fun.
Okay. All right. So again, how many teams, about how many teams we end up? How many, do you remember how many you had last year?
So we had eight teams in each league.
Were you able to fill it up?
We try to. Yeah. Our Wednesday, there's a bit of a change. It was a competitive league last year, and this year we're going to make it a rec league, so hopefully more teams can sign up.
And again, where are those plays? Are those plays at City Park?
City Park, yep.
The construction hasn't gotten in the way of the ball fields?
Not in the way of the ball fields.
And next year, with all the stuff that's going on over at the hole that used to be known as Treasure, will there be more ball fields available next year?
There are ball fields over there. If you drive by, you can see
they're already there.
There's turf being put in
okay.
over there.
Okay, will those be available to you guys this summer or not yet?
We won't be playing over there
okay.
for adult softball. We play on the grass and dirt at City Park.
Okay, so again, you have some registration deadlines.
Yes.
Okay, what are they?
Yeah, so for summer, our summer registration opens on April 1st at 7 a.m. for 84060 residents. And then April 3rd at 7 a.m. is everyone else.
Okay. Now, these are the programs I know that you're running. Do you want to sort of promote any programs that some of your colleagues are running this summer?
Yeah. We have, well, I will say we've got the Adult Volleyball League happening.
Is that played at City Park
it's
also?
It's played at City Park. We're still, like, determining where that'll be.
That's where the hole is.
Yes,
you used to play where the hole was, right?
Yeah. Well, yeah, kind of.
At
City Park there. Mm-hmm. So we've got fours and doubles, and those will start the first week of June and then the second week of June. But check out our website.
That's the website.
Yeah, tons of summer programming. We're excited about our pools, too. The weather, although, despite not great for skiing, it's great for construction. So stay tuned for our opening on that in June.
So, Megan, I'm going to give you the chance, since you're here, to promote the fall.
Yes, fall will be here before we even know it, but registration for our fall adult leagues open on June 1st. We're looking to have adult kickball, again, our social soccer league, and then flag football as well.
All right. Megan, anything else you want to touch on before we go?
That's all.
All right. Megan, thanks for spending time with me this morning.
Thanks so much, Roger.
On alternating school days since the fall, Wasatch High School students have been building a home. There's a morning crew and an afternoon crew. The home building program started in 1975 and has continued off and on since then. A house has been completed in each of the last five school years, with support from alum and Wasatch County local Joe Witt. This year, Witt took on a more significant role, guiding students throughout the process of framing the house, which included putting up and waterproofing walls, creating roof trusses, and pouring the foundation, as well as installing electrical and plumbing. Senior Brady Shea, who worked on designing the house and is now helping build it, said Witt was a great teacher.
He gave a bunch of great advice. When we would have downtime, he would come in, he'd kind of say, like, this is some examples of how we did this and this is what not to do. That he really wanted us to do our best work on this house.
That advice includes keeping a clean job site, no soda cans or stray nails on the ground, and no muddy shoes on unfinished floors. It's something he was known for as a respected Summit and Wasatch County custom home builder. Senior Diego Solorio said Witt motivated him to keep working on the house and pursuing a career in architecture. Witt had become an influential mentor for him.
He really stood up for us, trying to make our futures better, starting our careers. He was just a really big inspiration for me.
Witt was killed in an avalanche while snowmobiling outside of Midway on February 18th. News of his sudden death spread quickly and hit the community hard. Some students took time off from the class. Mark Barcombe, a fellow contractor who worked with Joe Witt Construction many times over the last 20 years, said the news of Witt's death was gut-wrenching. Barcombe said he was working with the homebuilding class in a smaller capacity, but is now taking on more in honor of Witt.
It was important to Joe to help the youth and give what he's learned, almost as a small micro apprenticeship.
He said working with the homebuilding students was the highlight of Witt's day. The students made construction fun again. Originally slated for a more behind-the-scenes role, Witt attended more and more classes as the year progressed because he loved being involved with the kids.
This was very important to him, and it actually brought him joy. It gave him a purpose. It was a break to do something different and give back and feel like we had some value in what we were doing.
First-time Wasatch High homebuilding teacher Canyon Prusso said it was important to Witt to know the students' names and goals so he could better help them achieve their career dreams. Prusso said Witt was also a huge help in getting the program off the ground this year.
The legacy Joe left for us is just the momentum that he built for us, the true excitement that he instilled in these kids. You know, it's been running as a class and it's been doing fine, but I think Joe just ratcheted it up another 100%.
On the job site near the Heber Valley Railroad, evidence of Witt's support is everywhere. The tools and trailer he lent to the program remain there. Another reminder of Witt is a transom window cut above the front door, where the builder wanted to install stained glass. Prusso said the students altered the design of an adjacent window so its top lines up with the transom. The plan was later scrapped due to the cost of stained glass, but now Prusso said the district will pay for the installation to honor Witt. Wasatch High interior design students created a mountain design for the stained glass piece.
It's really cool that this house will have that special feature. It'll be the only one, but it'll be like, you know, Joe's piece.
The home building class is still set to finish the house by the end of the school year. It will then be sold at cost to a Wasatch County School District employee. Witt's siblings have also set up the Joe Witt Future Builders Scholarship Legacy Fund to honor their brother. The scholarship will be awarded to Wasatch County students pursuing post-high school education involving building and the trades. Over $50,000 in community donations has been raised so far. Christine Weller, KPCW News.
You've been listening to the Local News Hour. Coming up, we'll have the community campfire. Amber Johnson will bring us part two of her Woman Rising story. And Andrea Buchanan speaks to a local family about their harrowing and life-affirming experience in Mexico. Then Nashville singer-songwriter Terry Joe Box, Emma Zink, and Carlisle Griffin will drop by for an in-studio performance. All that will be coming up right after the NPR News on the community campfire. And Monday on Mountain Money, Kevin and I will be talking to an author about the new book, It's On You. He challenges the thesis by Nobel Prize-winning economist Richard Thaler about the importance of nudges in changing human behavior.